This is episode 15 of the Courage to Be the Difference podcast. I'm your host, Sherry Ruskus, and this episode is part two of our Hidden Treasures series on the topic of imagination. If you missed part one, I encourage you to take a listen. In this interview, again with author and creative coach Cynthia Morris, we talk about what it took for Cynthia to bring an idea to life over the course of 12 years. If you have an idea that's been percolating for some time, I really encourage you to listen in and see what unfolds for you as you hear Cynthia's story. Remember, it's not over till it's over. Enjoy this episode and remember, as always, it takes courage to be and make a difference.
Let's talk a little bit, or not a little bit, a lot. I want to talk a lot about your latest and greatest project that's coming to life this week in your novel, Chasing Sylvia Beach. And I would love it if you could give some background and history of where the idea, the dream of it began, and how you've managed to keep it alive for 13 years.
Yeah, sure. I moved to Denver 21 years ago, and sometime around 1993, I got a job at Capitol Hill Books, which is directly across from the Capitol on Colfax Avenue. And it was kind of like my life dream to work in books, because I was always an avid reader. And so when I was there, I found this book called Sylvia Beach and the Lost Generation by a woman named Noel Riley Fitch. And Sylvia Beach was an American woman who moved to Paris in 1919 and opened a bookstore called Shakespeare and Company, which she kept open until 1942, when she shut it down in the face of the Nazi occupation of Paris. So I was so captured by this woman, by her ability to... So imagine me back in the 90s. I was in my 20s, and I didn't know who I was or what I was doing. I just knew I loved books. And this woman seemed to me like the perfect role model for what I considered a good life. Move to Paris, be surrounded by great, interesting, creative people, and contribute to the world of books and people who care about them. So I just kind of got obsessed with her, and I started doing performance pieces about her. At that time, I was doing some acting and some monologue and performing. And then that was also the time when, around 1994, 95, when my writing life started developing, and I started really focusing on being a writer and learning how to write. So, of course, I had the idea to write about Sylvia. I started writing a novel. It was also a screenplay. I tried a stage play, which was very impossible for me and my talents at the time. And then stuck with it as a novel. So I started writing a novel in 1999, and now it's done.
Wow. And you've had like 17 drafts of this. Can you talk about that transition? Because a lot of people would have given up at two or three, but you did it 17 times. Why so many, and what was the transition that happened during them?
Well, I'm the kind of person who, if I want to do something, I just plunge in. And I learn by doing, and that's very true for a novel. I'm not sure how else you learn how to write a novel except by trying. But I believe I've come to believe that writing a novel is very difficult. I don't know that I really have. So as I was going, imagine the first draft. There, just really knowing open.
Cynthia, you're breaking up a little bit on us. I didn't hear that last little bit there. Cynthia?
Okay. Can you hear me now? Is that better?
I can. Yes, you're back. Okay. You're back. Hooray.
Thanks for letting me know. I was saying that I didn't know how to write a novel, so the first drafts were pretty, probably pretty bad, and then each draft just got subsequently better and better, and there were even times when I had to, for instance, I got a grant from the Alliance Française, and I used the grant to go to Princeton University, where Sylvia Beach's archives are held. And I spent a week there, and when I came home, I really was disappointed that the novel, that I hadn't found anything interesting that I thought I didn't already know that I could put into the novel. So that was where the novel veered sharply. After, I think, a month or two of not doing anything on it, I suddenly, in a free write, had this scene where a young woman was speaking to Sylvia Beach at Sylvia Beach's bedside and asking her the kind of questions that she wanted to ask. And from there, the novel took a radically different turn and became a novel where a young woman, much like me, finds herself transported to Sylvia Beach's time in 1937 and has to figure out how to, you know, what's going on so she can find her way home. So that made for a radically different book. Suddenly, time travel, and I really had no idea how I was going to pull that off. So there were several drafts where that whole part of it wasn't very strong. And then when I thought the book was done and I was submitting it to agents, and agents were saying, sounds great, but you're not really pulling it off. Those were really tough transition points. Let's say there were two or three submission rounds where, and all through the submissions to publication, there was always a lot of interest in this book by agents and editors who would request the whole manuscript and then say, no thanks. This was a pretty disheartening moment where I really had to take huge leaps of faith to stay with it. And if you want to know some more specific stories about the more final revision, I can tell you that because that's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. And but before we get to that, could you tell me, like, were there times that it did just sit for a while? You needed to sit and just let it gel. But did the frustration get you to that point where you're just like, I've just got to let it sit for a little bit?
Well, that's a good question. It was more like life circumstances. Like, for instance, I was building my business this whole time alongside writing this book, and that demanded its own due. And then in 2008, I did this kind of radical thing where I packed up my life in Boulder and I put everything in storage and moved to Europe and kind of was on my own adventure to find my next step. But right before that, my agent had said, I just had gotten an agent, and he said, this is so great, it's 80% there, I would like a revision. And he pointed me toward what to revise. So then, you know, I'm getting on a plane, I'm flying off to this other adventure in May. So, you know, like, impossible to focus on the book. That's when I was really doing also work alongside with the Illustrated Journal. So it wasn't until November that year that I went to a writing retreat in the south of France and spent some time focusing to do the revision. So I think it's a lot, and I think that happens to people a lot, that, you know, a major life event will happen. You'll get married, or someone will become ill or die, and life happens, and you have to adjust for that. The trick is staying with it, going back to it before too long.
Right, before it starts to get just too cold, let's just say.
Yeah, and I'm pretty motivated to finish this book because I believed in the book. We talked, you know, in terms of the imagination, one way to use your imagination to stay with things is using your values. The values that kept me going with this was, I love a challenge, and I'm deadly curious. I just have to know. So I was really curious, well, what will happen with A in the story and what will happen once I publish the book? So right now I'm on the cusp of this big new step. I have no idea what's going to happen when I put the book out into the world, and I'm really curious to know what will happen. So that really motivated me to stay with it, really using my imagination of, well, what if, or what something, you know, wonderful surprises are waiting for me. I'm not going to not go there and finish.
And what I think is really cool is how you've really weaved a pretty intricate plan into this launch. And could you talk a little bit about that, the planning process in mixing planning with dreaming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I started working on the launch planning last July. I started working with a man named Dan Blank of We Grow Media, and he specializes in helping authors build their platform. And I was, you know, I came into it with the left brain charging straight ahead. We need to get followers. We need to build numbers, which is the publishing industry demands that you have a large platform. Like, do you have pull? Do you have thousands of people waiting to buy your book? No, I did not. So my goal was getting those numbers high. And thank God I found Dan Blank, who completely shifted me much more into the right brain and thinking, you know, what's this story about? What do you want to talk about in the space, like in your blog, that is meaningful to readers? Who are your readers and why will they care about this? So that felt like a very different approach to me. It's very strategic, but it's also coming from a deeply meaningful place. And that forced me to, you know, pointed me to look at values and themes and, well, what do I care about and what do I want to share in this book? And pretty much all the concern about numbers dropped away, which felt like a relief. It became much more enjoyable. So it's funny, you know, so many moving pieces. I had to kind of divide it into four sections. There was the website, there was the actual book itself, like finishing the book, having it edited, having it designed. And then there was the platform building, and then there's the launch. So that was how I used the planning to kind of divide the four major components of the project. And within each one, then Dan helped me really flesh it out. He also helped me flesh out my content, the things I was going to write about. So then I broke that down into a kind of a month-by-month plan. But for me, I kind of can plan 80%. And then there's a lot of calibration as I go. There's a lot of adding and tracking and changing. So it's really, again, it's that agility between the left and the right brain. And my assistant helped me put the plan into a document that's on a timeline, and it's all very extremely organized. And ironically, it's funny, as I'm in these last weeks, I'm not using it hardly at all. Like, I'm not even using it as a to-do list. I just, somehow I have it all in my head. I don't know. It's very weird to me how the left and the right and the planning and the imagination are working together at this last minute, because I would think I would need to be very rigidly following the to-do list. But I'm kind of more managing a to-do list on a daily basis and following what I know needs to be done in the moment. So I think, I don't know if other people are like this. I think it helps to have a really good plan. It somehow settles the mind who just like, oh, my gosh, we have a million moving pieces to handle. You can get that on paper at some point. And then however you use it can be really fluid and flexible and responsive in a daily basis. I think that's what I'm doing. I bet other people operate like that too.
Yeah, because I feel like if I get too rigid sometimes that, to-do list, got to do this, got to do that, that I start to lose that creative edge. And I just don't flow as well.
Yeah, and Sherry, we haven't said the word intuition yet, but I think that is a big, big part of that right brain and creative, and what's your sense of this? And so I've just gotten really good at running it through both sides of me, running it through both filters, like, do I really want to spend that much money on that? And then it's like, yes, it's the right thing to do. I'm enjoying it. It's really quite, I feel like I've earned this. I trust in myself. I've written and launched several ebooks and tours and lots of other things. So I've built an experience base in how to complete and put things out into the world, and also have a lot of help.
And talk about your help.
Well, there's the higher level thinking help that I mentioned, Dan, who helped me really strategize a big picture and a plan. And then working with Jonathan Fields, he's my mentor. He's in his Good Life Project, which is kind of, he doesn't use this term, but I use it. I call it a business incubator. It's a year-long program that I just started in March. So he's been helpful with the launch and kind of some of the logistics at launch time. And also very much like Dan, pointing toward the heart and pointing toward simplicity. He's super helpful because I'm sure other people listening are like this. We like to complicate things. Like we imagine all these grand scenarios and then we realize that's very complicated. So he's helping me simplify. And then Allison Stanfield, she's a marketing expert for artists. She's very influential in a lot of my systems and processes, like the shipping. She's amazing with all of that. And then my assistant, Uli, who's really helping with, you know, a lot of the micro details of the shipping and addresses and keeping everything straight. So that is, the initial people. There's a ton of other people. All of my friends are helping for the launch party. And this is a big deal. I've written about this for other blogs. We often are very reluctant to get help. But what I'm finding right now is that there's no way I can pull this off by myself. Absolutely impossible. And so some part of me kind of sets this up so that I can, I'm forced to ask for help. I'm forced to receive the help. And it's been the best gift in this whole process, how fun it is to see each of my friends stepping forward with what they uniquely offer to help make this special. For the launch, I'm doing a special limited edition of 200 copies of the book that come with a special piece of art that I've created, and it's specially wrapped and shipped. And I'm offering that through Thursday, June 21st, and then on Friday the 22nd, that's when it's officially available online at other bookstores. So that was a big, big decision that I had to make. A lot of, a left brain approach would say, don't do that. It's just much more simple to just have it distributed through print on demand. But I had to do something creative. I had to do something that was special for the people who have been with me throughout this time. And I find that that's been really a lifesaver for me, because I've been dealing with things on a very physical level, paper, all the products that are going into that edition. And it's a beautiful relief from sitting at the computer, because if I didn't have that, I would be just at the computer manipulating digital files all day for this launch. And you can really only do so much of that. So I never know if I'm answering your question.
you're doing an excellent job. And it's just, it's so great to get into the mind of such a creative as yourself. And when we're doubting our, when some of us that don't get to spend that much time in the creative mode, it's awesome. So you're doing fabulous. One of the questions I have is, okay, so you had this dream, you were going to have a publisher do this. And, I talked to so many writers and authors all the time that there's that day that comes, do I continue on this path towards, traditional publishing, or do I self-publish? And what changed, what shifted in your dream that you said, if this is going to come to life, I'm gonna have to self-publish it?
That's a great question, because it was a very distinct moment when I knew. I think it was 2010. For Christmas, I went to California for a writing retreat to work on the novel. And had a great time and really, made some progress and came home. And it was the new year, January 2011. And it's like, well, what am I going to focus on? What's my thing? And the novel is my main thing. I really want to drive home this year. So I saw some article about the publishing industry, and it was so clear to me all of a sudden that there was nothing I could do to this book that was going to make it good enough for a publisher, and that just because the bar is so high, they're just not going to take a risk on a book that's just good. It has to be great, and so, or, you know, great in a commercial way. It may not be well written, but it could be commercially great. So when I realized, oh, it's really not a matter of is my book good enough, it's really just like kind of the nature of the publishing industry, and that told me, I said, this is, you're going to publish this book. And I took the decision that I was going to do it, and I felt so great. I felt enormous relief that I didn't have to keep hoping and praying that somebody else would think it was good enough, that no matter, you know, like this final draft, it would be good enough. And then I also really felt an enormous surge of power and creativity. I thought, I'm in charge. I'm in control of this, which is good and bad. But it made me feel like I could decide when and how it would be published. And so I took that with great joy. And now, you know, here I am a year and a half later with the final book. So that was a deciding moment.
Really, and really making your dream a reality. I mean, that's what, you know, and I love hearing about that is that there are times that you just have to decide if this dream is going to happen, nobody but me can make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're waiting for, you know, whether that amazing client to walk through our door or, you know, all those things to have happen that are out of our control. And you took control.
I want to talk about control and tell a little story because I think it's pretty remarkable. It goes back to, you mentioned juju, and I think of juju as that kind of magical synchronicity, serendipity that happens that we couldn't plan. And that's, to me, the gift of trusting your right brain, trusting your intuition, trusting yourself, and going for something that seems really ludicrous. And I think if you look behind most businesses, you'll see that it was kind of that ludicrous decision, like, well, what if we, you know, do this crazy thing? So it was the spring of 2010, and my agent was like, you know what, I'm just not getting any traction. I don't think, you know, I can keep going with submitting. And it was clear that I needed to do another revision. And by then, I'm ready to split my throat. I'm just... I was mad and resentful and okay, fine. So I had had a plane ticket to Paris, so I said, fine, if I'm going to do this revision, I'm going to Paris, I'm going to drink a lot of rosé and eat a lot of pastries and just get some inspiration. And I kind of said to my guides, I said, this is it. This is the last version, so just know that. Hear my stand, this is it. And so I went to Paris, and it was a trip that was so incredibly filled with juju that it was really clear to me. I felt very supported and guided in, like, a bigger sense. I met a Frenchman who turned out to be become a very good friend, and I would call him a book doctor. He helped me revise the last draft. He helped develop some of the subplots and make it much stronger. And my relationship with him over that year was incredible. You couldn't ask for something better than somebody like that to come in and help. Also, while I was in Paris, I met Carrie Walsh. She had just come out with a book, The Letters of Sylvia Beach. I happened to be at the Shakespeare and Company bookstore, saw that she was doing a reading, and I went to her reading, and then we had tea. She really was excited about my novel, and then she wrote a blurb for the book. She's on the cover of the book. So, you know, that would never have happened if I had not gone to Paris. There was just a lot of other stories from that trip that were really remarkable. But I feel like it's some kind of cosmic reward for taking risks and being foolish and not knowing. So my risk, I know where my risk level is. I never risk a lot of money or my health or things that are important to me. But so everybody's got to have their own risk factor. I'm not out there just telling everybody, like, woo, just go wild and don't worry about a thing. Hope that makes sense.
Totally. And you know what I love is that how when you ran into Carrie Walsh, who wrote Letters of Sylvia Beach, you know, sometimes people go, oh, look, somebody else already did it. You know, it's not going to happen for me now because she already did it. No, you jumped right in and collaborated with her and made it even a stronger situation. And now she's one of your, as we call them, JV, joint venture partners, where you're, you know, working together to promote this whole idea of Sylvia Beach.
Well, and yes, I want to build on what you said. The timing is really everything. And when I started writing this novel in 1999, I mean, I barely had a computer. I just had started with a computer. I had no way of knowing that by the time the book was finally done, self-publishing would be where it is now. So look at the amazing ability for people to say, well, yeah, you know, the publishing industry is not going to take a risk on this book, but I will, and I'll ask my readers to. That was a huge gift. And the timing of running into Carrie and that she had published a book of Sylvia Beach's letters, that Sylvia Beach was coming kind of back into the space and other people were leading and paving the way. For instance, the book that Noel wrote was just translated into French last year. So now the whole French-speaking world can access that book. And Noel won a prize for it. So now my book comes in on the tale of those things about Sylvia Beach coming out. And I just think that's another thing that we just don't control, and we don't, we only when we look back we can say, oh, wow, look at the timing of all of that. It was perfect.
Absolutely, absolutely. And tell us a little bit more about how your Sylvia Beach is different or how your book is different than those and what have you come to love about this book?
Well, this is fiction. My book is fiction. It's totally fictionalized and so based on a lot of research. But Noel's book is a straight-up biography. Noel is an amazing biographer. She wrote biographies of Julia Child and Anais Nin and many other books. But this book about Sylvia Beach that she wrote is just so full of detail and research. It's meticulous. It's amazing. If you really like want to know the backstory about Sylvia Beach, that's the book to read. It's called Sylvia Beach and the Lost Generation. And then Carrie's book, she edited the letters of Sylvia Beach. So she was a Sylvia Beach fan. She's an academic. She's a professor. And she was in the archives looking at these letters and thought, these letters are amazing. They tell a story. So she got a publishing deal to bring out the letters of Sylvia Beach. So those two books are very factual. They're really, you know, about Sylvia. And mine is completely made up fictional book.
Got it.
Based on Sylvia.
But based on historical facts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And what else do you want to share with us about the book? And maybe even what the book has taught you about yourself.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, I think it's maybe been clear in what I've said so far, but what I really want to emphasize is building that kind of faith and trust in yourself, faith in the project that it is important, and trust in yourself that you will keep showing up for it as long as it is important to you. It's really got to be meaningful for you on a deep, deep level, or you're not going to be able to stay with it. It can't be just somebody else's good idea or a surface level, oh, this is a great marketing idea or a great idea for my business. It has to really be rooted in what you care about on a very profound level. And so that makes it good. It gives you the motivation. It also can make it very scary because it means so much you don't want to screw it up. But so for people to really believe in their vision, and it will always change. It will never look the way you thought it would. That's very rare. And then what was the second question? What have I learned about myself?
Right.
What I learned about myself, oh, my goodness, like, who knew I was so persistent? I had no idea. I believe I wrote an e-book called Cross the Finish Line. It's about how people can complete their projects. And what I wrote in there and what I believe to be true is that every project we have works us and has a gift for us. But you can't get that gift unless you stay with the project and complete it. And for me, completing this book taught me that I am way more persistent than I thought, that I can suck up very difficult situations. I mean, don't get me wrong, like there were times when I was very unhappy about this book and very weighed down by it, because I was not going to not do it. I had to do it so I could do other things. And so being able to stay with it despite it not feeling good is a characteristic that I've really developed. And I think that really, this whole book has really contributed to my creative maturity. And I was very pleased to be finished and pleased with how it looks. And it's such a joy to be done. I'm surprised that during this last time of launch week, I'm much more excited than I am scared. I don't know what happened, but somewhere along the way, I really had to shift from worrying what other people would think about it, because my big fear was my book would be terrible. People would look at me and say, she's a writer's coach and her book is so bad. and then we see like the worst case scenario, my whole entire career crumbles. And so, right, and this is what I wanted to mention, another way to use our imagination. Our imagination loves those worst case scenarios, like where you're just like, you're a pile of ash at the end of it because you dared to write a book. And so I invite people to look at, well, what's the best case scenario and what's something in between, to really use your imagination to go the range and not just focus on all the really terrifying things that could happen to you.
I love it even in thinking about, and I'd love to squeeze this in our last few minutes, because I know there's a lot of people listening that maybe want to write, haven't been able to get it, and you know my feelings as a business coach. I think that writing is critical in this day and age, that it's just such an important asset to have for your business, whether it allows you to blog or just the communications that we have to do through writing today. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I know there's a whole huge topic that we could talk about for an entire hour by itself, but how that writing piece of letting go and letting that writing come out of you.
Well, you're right that writing is really, I call it a gateway skill. If you can't communicate, whether you're in business or whether you're an employee, you're not going to go very far. Like, you need that ability to articulate your message. So for business, people who are in business and they need to write for their business and they don't like to write or don't want to write, looking for ways that they can really make it simple. Like, it might be just find a formula for your blog post. It's a bullet-pointed list, 5 ways to. Like, use those simple templates, use those simple forms to write, and don't worry about being, Hemingway or Shakespeare. Just try to be as simple and succinct and clear as possible. And then practice, just practicing. And you and I have both used free writing a lot, where you just write everything you think about it, dump it out on paper, and then bring some order to it. That is a tactic that I use with my clients and my students, and no matter what people are writing, whether personal or professional, free writing is a great way to get into the flow and silence that critical mind that tells you that your spelling and grammar and punctuation is incorrect.
Absolutely, and I just have such fond memories of the free writes. Back in the day, in your little apartment there in Boulder, was just the best. It was the best.